Hello, and welcome back to a new year of Write Up Your Algae. As we often do, we have been on a bit of a break, as Clara has started her master's work and I finish up my bachelor's degree. Part of my New Year's resolution was to get out 20 episodes of Write Up Your Algae this year, which is one every 2 weeks, with some wiggle room, of course. To start off the year, we are going to have a Biosphere Bulletin episode for you today, which just means Claire and I will be talking about some recent news in biology and environmental science.
I love it.
Who shall go first today?
Emily shall.
2024 saw roughly 190 new species of animals identified, but most remarkably, 27 come from a single 38-day biodiversity survey in the Alto Mayo region of Peru. This expedition was done in 2022, but the results were not published until this year. I have credited the original article, however, it is entirely in Spanish, so I did have to get some information from some English news sources instead. The survey recorded over 2,000 species of flora and fauna in a region that is actually highly disturbed due to a high human population density and agricultural development. Dr. Trond Larsen led the survey, and he said he was shocked at the species richness and the number of species unique to this disturbed landscape. Surveys were done using eDNA, or environmental DNA, camera traps, and bioacoustic sensors. So, what are these survey methods really? Well, eDNA takes samples, often from water, and researchers will extract residual DNA from organisms that have been nearby. This method is increasing in popularity, but continues to have some shortcomings. Some organisms can leave behind lots of DNA, while others may never be detected with this method. So it may over or under account for a species presence in an area. Bioacoustics, however, is often used for birds. It records sound long-term in a non-invasive manner and uses machine learning to determine the calls of birds in an area, like the Merlin app, if you've ever used that. This has also been used for whales, I believe, so like very like vocally unique animals, as well as camera traps or trail cams, which is pretty self-explanatory. They record video that can either be watched back manually to identify the species, or a machine learning software can be applied, but I've heard that that's still very new, like that kind of technology isn't particularly accurate yet. Of the species discovered in this landmark expedition, four mammals were discovered, including an amphibious mouse, a short-tailed fruit bat, a spiny mouse, and a dwarf squirrel, with the semi-aquatic mouse being particularly exciting given their rarity and difficulty to collect. As well, a really cute salamander was found, with stubby legs and a mottled chestnut coloration, and the most adorable little mouth. I have to show you, Clara, just because it's the cutest thing I've ever seen. His little mouth, do you see it?
Oh,
it looks like almost like a little, I don't know, like a mustache or a cat
cute?
Bone.
He's really
cute.
He looks
like cute. A little old man.
I know, he's adorable.
With big puppy eyes. We'll have to post a picture.
Yeah. Oh, there's going to be pictures of all of these. As well, there was a bizarre-looking speckled blob-headed fish, seemingly related to catfish. This fish has a bulbous extension on its head that researchers speculate could be related to sensory, or maybe buoyancy, or maybe it's fat reserves, which really means they have no clue. 7 fish were found, 1 frog, 10 butterflies, and most excitingly, 48 more species yet to be confirmed as new. The survey also found 49 threatened species, including the Peruvian yellow-tailed woolly monkey, a San Martin titi monkey, the speckle-chested piculet, the long-whiskered owlet, and an endangered harlequin frog. Researchers hope this survey will bolster conservation and a network of local protected areas.
I love it. That's such happy news, Emily. Unfortunately, my news story is not so happy.
Aw,
I'm sorry.
Say it ain't so.
Yeah, it is so. And it's also kind of short, but here we go. So the charity Bug Life in the UK has observed a phenomenon this winter that has been of some concern recently. As our winters become more mild, bumblebees have been popping up throughout December and January. This year, it has been observed that 2 out of the 25 native species of bumblebees in the UK have started to build nests early. Yeah. The issue is that early nesting can lead to nest failure and collapse of the colony. Queen bees will hibernate under leaves or underground when the weather becomes cold. Due to the mildness of our winters, some queen bees have started to come out of hibernation and build their nests. Worker bees were spotted this year during Christmas break. Emily, what do you think might cause the collapse of a colony during the winter.
Oh, that they'll freeze when the temperatures do drop.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons. Of course, there's that constant threat of the weather becoming much colder and them freezing to death. But there's also another issue, and that is the shortages of flowers from which bees can collect pollen and nectar. Of course, the milding of winters also has impacts on different insects and organisms such as ticks, which the news article also talked about, but I didn't want to be too depressing, so I didn't want to bring up ticks. And I think they deserve a whole other episode for themselves.
Mm. So, unfortunately, Clara, my next one is a little depressing, too.
Oh, no, it just keeps getting worse.
I'm going to try and stay on a light note with this, but it is, as we know, it can be difficult, especially when we're talking about conservation, to always stay on the bright side of things, because there's not always a bright side of things. Sometimes we have to be conscious of the not-so-great news. So for my next news story, we're going to have a right whale watch.
I'm so excited.
Where I'm going to give you the rundown of how right whales have finished off 2024. So in 2023, there were 12 new calves born. But we are actually up to 15 surviving calves this year. Oh, so we are up. 20 calves were born. So that is a mortality of 5, which is unfortunate. But the fact that we have, even though it's 3, these numbers are really important. So there were 3 more calves born and are still surviving to this day, as far as we know, up from last year. There are currently 70 active reproductive females who calf roughly every 6 to 10 years. But due to increased stressors they are under, this often extends the calving periods closer to the decade mark, with a high juvenile mortality. This species will only return to stable when 50 or more calves per year will be born, but we're obviously not there yet. Our last calf of the year was spotted off of southern Virginia from a first-time whale mother, number 4540. Right whales calf off of New England and below southern Nova Scotia in the shallow waters and are largely monitored through aerial surveys, tagging, and necropsies of washed ashore whales. NOAA is where I get a majority of my right whale information from, and they post updates throughout the year. So I'm just going to give you the last update of the year, which was given on December 16th, 2024. The Clearwater Marine Aquarium Research Institute spotted whale number 5132, a juvenile male born in 2021 east of North Carolina. This whale was last spotted in the Bay of Fundy in October of 2024, healthy and gear-free, but found himself entangled with several lines crossing his head and mouth, with 2 buoys attached to the line. There is also a single line trailing the whale approximately 100 feet. Biologists reviewed this entanglement and determined that the whale will unfortunately die from its injuries, as weather at the time did not currently permit a response. However, if it is spotted again in the future, they will try again, if it's accessible.
So it just wasn't accessible at the time?
Yeah, the weather after it was spotted wasn't good enough weather for them to, like, send a team out to try and remove it. But I also think it helps you understand what to do if you see a right whale. You're going to stay 500 yards away minimum. If you're closer than that for whatever reason, maybe it snuck up on you, cut your engine and wait for the whale to pass. You're going to want to snap a picture and grab a GPS point and report that to either the Department of Fisheries and Oceans if you're a Canadian, or NOAA if you're an American. The Canadian number is 1-844-800-8568. For some good news moving forward, during necropsies, fishing gear is now being traced back to its owners. There's hope for companies contributing to this issue to be held accountable in a meaningful way that will encourage more conscious fishing practices. While calving has increased this year, so did mortality. We are ending this year with 372 whales, and we are far from out of the woods yet.
So, Emily, just for anybody who doesn't know, can you explain what a necropsy is?
Oh, totally. So a necropsy is, I guess, the animal equivalent of an autopsy. So it is, you will basically cut a thing open and you'll see what's going on. You might try and diagnose how it died. You might see what injuries it had had. A big thing, I guess, that people like to look for when sharks and whales wash up, as they like to cut open their stomach. They want to see what they're eating, what their last meal was. What's really important with right whale autopsies, kind of like I said, is diagnosing the problem. A lot of times you'll be able to tell there's one of 2 big causes of mortality. It's were they bonked on the head by a boat, or were they entangled in fishing gear and, you know, whatever happened from there. So those are the big contributors there are just boat collisions and entanglements.
On to my next story. I don't know if this is good or bad, but we'll see.
So let's think of some problems that we have with environmental pollution. One of the main ones is, of course, garbage. However, the proper disposal of garbage is heavily debated, I feel like. What's the best way to do that? In Greenland, they're testing a way to remove most of the garbage from the landfills, but also to heat half of the population of Nuuk. And I hope I pronounced that right. Nuuk is the capital of, like, the largest city in Greenland. Mm-hmm. So in January of 2024, a new incinerator was established in Nuuk, where about 2,000 kilograms of garbage are being burnt in the incinerator every hour. This garbage is being collected and brought from the community and surrounding communities to the incinerator. The heat that is produced from this incinerator heats about 4,000 to 10,000 homes compared to the 19,000 people that reside there. So that's about half. About 90% of all the garbage that is put through the incinerator is fully burned. Most of the materials that cannot be burned include metals and cans, which can then be recycled and reused, and then the rest is put into landfills. The incinerator also includes a chemical treatment to remove toxins from getting emitted into the air. More of these incinerators are planned for the future to heat homes in Greenland. As well, there has been some talk since 2014 of starting this project in Iqaluit in Nunavut. This has been proposed as a way to manage waste and also to heat the homes of people. However, it has not come to pass yet since COVID and a bunch of other delays in production. It's also important to note that although we think burning garbage might not be an effective way, also think about how people are getting their heat currently, which would be through boats or trucks shipping oil up to these areas and then people burning the oils to heat their homes. So really we're looking at a trade-off and which is the best way for the environment. So on that note, Emily, I just wanted to know what you think about that.
I feel like it's one of those things. I'd be interested to see what the numbers are, how it actually compares in, like, what the emission is, the emission differences there. Because I think our gut reaction, maybe for me, I'm like, oh, don't throw plastic in the fire. No, it's going to be polluting the air. And then I think about, well, of course, my home is heated through oil and gas, you know? Yeah. So it's, yeah, I wonder if, I mean, I feel like I have that gut reaction that it's not a good thing. But like you said, you think about the alternative. Maybe it's a two birds with one stone kind of solution.
Yeah, so the thing that I thought was interesting while just reading this news article was that, one, they said it's not like a typical incinerator where you just throw garbage in. It's much more expensive to build because they do have a process to remove some of those toxins, or hopefully most of the toxins before being emitted into the air. The other alternative is throwing your garbage into a landfill, which is just going to stockpile and end up in the ocean or what have you. And then also the other negative, which is using a boat which runs on fossil fuels to ship oil to these areas to then burn the oil. And on that point, too, it would be much more expensive to ship oil and have it burn compared to creating your own heat within your community. So it was kind of an interesting, like, kind of challenging myself to see what I think. And if I could think outside the box of something like that as well. It obviously, it's not ideal. You probably hope people would heat their homes by solar power, but that's not always possible. And I think it's...
Especially in an area that might be dark for half the year.
Exactly. Or, like, solar or wind or something like that. But that's not always possible. So you have to come up with a solution that's best for the community. And not saying that this is what we should do for the rest of the world, but in areas where we're pretty isolated from other people, this is a potential method. Yeah.
So for my last news story today, this is good news, I promise. Okay. We're ending on a positive note, at least for me. I wanted to talk about Science, the journal. Science, the journal.
Ah, science.
Science, the journal. And their breakthrough of the year. This has been a tradition done by science since 1989, which started off as Molecule of the Year, as a kind of spoof on Time's Person of the Year, but changed in 1996 to Breakthrough of the Year, to honor progress towards the understanding of HIV and the first antiviral drugs. HIV-related research has won the award again in 2011 due to the rise of antivirals that could prevent and treat HIV. Yet again, in 2024, the award has gone to advancements towards HIV treatment and prevention, aiming to make it more accessible to those who are most vulnerable. So pre-exposure prophylaxis pills became accessible to the public in 2012, at least in America, which was a daily pill, but was less effective for those who were most vulnerable because they were less likely to take it daily. So in the US and Canada, HIV largely infects injection drug users who are much less likely to take a daily pill. So it wasn't, even though this was developed, you know, for vulnerable populations to HIV, they weren't, it didn't work for them and their lifestyle. In 2021, however, a once every 2 month shot became available, but it was at a high cost. Of course, this is very significant in an American context due to their for-profit healthcare system. And a person who is an injection drug user maybe being less likely to have insurance. This year's breakthrough of the year is for a new pre-exposure prophylaxis called lenacapavir. This works a bit differently to its predecessor. Rather than affecting the replication of the virus, it affects the capsid of the virus, causing it to harden, thus preventing the virus from entering the nucleus of cells and therefore replicating. So it kind of like went a step earlier in the process. Ah. This new drug can be administered as a shot, and it actually works for 6 months at a time. So it's an even longer period, making it more accessible, and hopefully, fingers crossed, it can be made cheaper.
Okay. That's great news.
So what do you have for your last story?
Yeah, so my last story is not depressing. I tried to end on a high note. I mean, it is a little bit, but it's, you know, it's very innovative. So I'm very excited to share. So first, let's talk about the problem that this story centers around, which is the water hyacinth. The water hyacinth is one of the most invasive species in the world, and it grows on the water surface and covers that surface, thereby blocking the sunlight and kills plants and wildlife underneath the surface of the water. As told in a news story from Kenya, fishermen have lost their nets in the dense vegetation, and fishermen have also been trapped for hours waiting for rescue by helicopter due to this water hyacinth problem. The problem can cost up to $700 million annually to deal with, and of course, amplifying this problem is land use changes and climate change. It has become very severe in Kenya and thus has created a new wave of solutions to solve this problem. To mention a few is introducing weevils that can restrict spread and cause the plant to lose buoyancy. The other is to harvest the plant and combine it with other organics such as cow manure to create biofuels. However, in 2021, a student from Egerton University in Kenya got stuck in a boat for 5 hours due to the water hyacinth problem. From that day, he wanted to come up with a solution. And as a final project to one of his courses, Shutharu, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, developed Hyapak Ecotech Limited, a Kenyan company that creates bioplastics from dried water hyacinths. Hyapak takes dried water hyacinth that is collected from fishermen in Kenya and combines them with additives and binders to shape and mold the bioplastics into a desired product. The company pays fishermen for collecting and providing these dried water hyacinth, which gives them an opportunity for a passive income. And Hyapak has since won the youth category at the East Africa Climate Action Awards, a prize at UNESCO's World Engineering Day Hackathon, and a prototype for Humanity Award 2023, announced at COP28 Climate Conference. Shutharu also received the 2023 Obama Foundation Africa Leader Award. And this company probably couldn't have come at a better time. In 2017, plastic packaging in Kenya was banned, and in 2020, all single-use plastics were banned. Now, although we think of this as a good thing, there can also be some negatives to this. When you don't produce an alternative for people who live in poorer areas to use plastics, it can become harder for them to source an alternative. And because of this, it has been reported that people are smuggling single-use plastics into Kenya. There's another issue with the Hyapak company, and that is funding. Because it's a new company and is just getting started, it doesn't have a lot of resources or money to expand its operation. An initiative that has been proposed is that Hyapak kind of get their foot in the door with the Kenyan government. So, according to the Global Forest Watch, it reported that Kenya has lost 14% of their tree cover in the last 22 years. And without some immediate action, we could see completely degraded forest areas. The Kenyan government is committed to planting about 15 billion seedlings. However, what are they using to plant these seedlings? You know, the seedling bags that trees usually come in, it's like plastic?
So what's an alternative they can use? Well, these dried water hyacinth bioplastics, which not only degrade, but release nitrogen into the soil as they're degrading. And they can also help to increase water retention in the soil so that the seedlings will need to source less water in their initial stage of development. On top of this, there's also the reduction of your carbon footprint. You're not producing as much plastics when you're planting these seedlings. Since the beginning of the company, Hyapak has also been exporting to the US and to Germany, and plans to establish more franchises in the other two countries which have a huge water hyacinth problem, which are India and El Salvador.
As with all of these like new technologies that come about that are like, oh, this is going to save the world, it all depends on if they can really take off and if people will use them and like invest in that. So I really hope that this is one of the ones that do take off, because I feel like every year I'm like, oh, the new corn-powered car, you know, like it's there's always something.
Well, the thing that I found really interesting about this is it's kind of talking about that circular economy. So you have a problem that you need to solve, which is this invasive plant, which is killing a lot of the wildlife. It's a really big problem in the wetlands. Obviously, it's a big issue for the people in these locations, like the fishermen who are stuck on their boats or lose their nets or can't provide for their families. And so they can take this plant that's causing them all these issues, harvest it, get the money from it, and also create these single-use biodegradable plastics, which will degrade within a few months and help produce them at a cheap cost for everyday people. It's a really cool invention to kind of think of it that way. It's been since 2021 that they've started this company. And they seem to be expanding, but hopefully they can get more funding for sure. And I never knew that water hyacinths existed and that they were such a big problem.
Whenever I hear hyacinth, I think of Bridgerton. I think of the like little sister character.
Yeah, but I'll post some pictures because it's kind of like there was a lot of them.
Yeah. Check out the Instagram. We're definitely going to be uploading lots of pictures, especially of our new species discovered this year. But yeah, it's good to be back. You can expect another episode 2 weeks after we upload this one. I'm going to be talking about a very cuddly creature, just to give you a hint. Anyways, I know we've been a mix of good and bad news today, but thank you so much for listening, and we hope this episode was right up your algae.